Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Close Up. I'm your host, Joe, and this week's Ryan, Yoni Collins, a documentary filmmaker and a good friend of mine from back in film school. So, Yoni, we're going into our medium shot now. Tell me about your background as a documentary filmmaker. How did you get into this?
It's been a bunch of years now. After my first year at York University, I did a summer program in Israel. It's called the Jerusalem Film Workshop, which was an international documentary film workshop for everyone. It was for filmmakers from all over the world. So we had some from US, I was from Canada, Vietnam, Nepal, all over. And that's where I really got into documentary for the first time. I produced a short doc called Hamavdil, which was about the market in Jerusalem. And we produced a feature doc called Travelers that came out at the Jerusalem Film Festival that year to wrap up the program. And yeah, fell in love with documentary. I'm obsessed with it. And I just kind of spiraled from there.
So you tried it out basically just as I've never tried a documentary before, and this seems like an opportunity to give that a shot.
Yeah, exactly. The program was geared towards docs. And I really, really liked it. It was a lot more fluid. It was a lot more flexible. It's more of a ongoing craft as opposed to setting everything up and doing it like that first. I really like the free flow, and I really like that working with people and their stories. And that's really what got me into it, yeah.
So how big usually are your documentary crews? Is it just basically you and a camera, or do you have a couple people who work with you on these?
It really varies, but I keep it small usually. Most of the last year, it's just been me with a camera, and occasionally I bring on one to two other people. Most of the time, I just like working in a group of maximum 5-6 people. I just prefer director, camera, maybe a second camera, sound sometimes. And yeah, that's the way I like to do it. It keeps it a lot more intimate, keeps it a lot more personal, and that's just the way I like working.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure that creates a sense of ease with your subjects as well. Less intense than a whole group of people all in your face asking you hard-hitting questions about whatever your subject is.
Yeah, exactly. And I work usually with intense subjects, which is why it's a lot more comfortable for them, a lot more comfortable for me. I just like keeping it personal and as one-on-one as possible.
So you say you like working more with the intense subjects. You're not a fluff and filler kind of guy. No documentaries on just the mundane in life. You go for the real meat.
Usually, yeah. I think the most mundane ones I do are music documentaries. I love doing music docs just because they're more fun, and I love working with musicians and editing to music and playing around with that. So I've done a couple of those, but usually, yeah, I just go for the meat of it.
Your one, it's called Lantern Slicker, right? That one's still running in festivals currently. That one seems pretty...
Yeah, in the UK today.
That one seems like the perfect melding of what you're talking about. You love the music, but it's also hard-hitting subject matter.
Exactly. That one, so it's interesting. The first documentary I remember loving when I was a kid was Shut Up and Sing, which is the documentary about the Chicks. Then they were called the Dixie Chicks, the country band. And I really liked that because it was a story about a band. It blended music, but it was also political, and it was very interesting how it kind of blended the war in Iraq with the making of an album and that kind of thing. So that was a big inspiration for me. That was probably my biggest inspiration to documentaries when I was a kid. And that's kind of what led me to do Lantern Slicker in that style.
Well, tell me more about that, about how music impacts that story.
In Lantern Slicker?
Yes.
So Lantern Slicker was interesting because I heard about it. I heard about the story of it on Remembrance Day in 2021. So it was November 11th Canadian Remembrance Day, and I was surfing the internet, just going through stories like I usually do every year about veterans and just different stories about war, because I served in an army. I served in the Israeli army, so I connect to that a lot. And that year, it was right after the Taliban took over Afghanistan and the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan. So a lot of the Canadian stories were also about Afghanistan. And I saw this article that really stuck out to me because the headline was Canadian Afghanistan War Veteran Uses Music to Help Treat PTSD. And I was super interested in that because it's everything I can relate to: war, PTSD, music, all of it. And then I read the article, and this guy's name is Dennis McKenzie. He's a very, very good friend of mine now. And I had not heard of him. He lives out in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. Actually, Bonshaw, Prince Edward Island. I landed in Charlottetown and we filmed there. And I reached out to him. I heard his album and I loved it. He basically created an album, concept album called The Guardian Angel Platoon, which was telling his story from drafting until coming home and dealing with PTSD and his friends suffering from PTSD who were committing suicide, because that was a massive thing in Canada that no one was hearing about. And it was really affecting Canadian veterans. And then he used music to help himself heal and wrote an album about his experience. And that really brought him full circle and used music to raise awareness of mental health for veterans and suicide for veterans and or veteran suicide. And we've been at that since. So his album came out the day before that Remembrance Day in 2021. And then we filmed it a year later in August.
That's very powerful. Definitely. It's, one question I had about calling to mind that you had such a close affinity for the subject matter of this. I wanted to ask, what, in your opinion, should documentarians be closer to their subject matter or more impartial? Because when I look at the creative process, I wonder if passion might instill more biases into the subject matter, or if objective impartiality might be too clinical in the presentation process. Do you think it's better to be closer to your subject or more of an outside observer just finding out what they can?
So I don't think any documentary can be 100% subjective or objective. I think there's always both in it. For me, if I want to direct a documentary, I have to have some kind of connection to the subject matter or the theme. It doesn't have to necessarily be to the person. Like, I didn't know Dennis before, but I had experience in music and PTSD and veterans and that kind of work. I think you have to be well enough versed in it that you have a objective view of it, but also a personal connection to it. And that's usually the way I choose which docs I want to direct. And if I don't have that, I usually will not take on a project. And sometimes I'll help someone produce and that kind of thing, but I won't go all in on it unless I have a personal connection.
So especially for these kind of stories where you have a deep passion and you have a personal stake in the story in a way, because you relate to these things so strongly, do you believe in putting yourself in the narrative whatsoever, or do you prefer to relegate yourself to the documentarian role, the compiler and presenter, and that's it?
For me, I'm usually in the documentarian role. I don't like being on camera. Even this is a bit weird for me. I'm always behind the scenes. Like, I love that kind of thing. For me, it's not about me. Like, it's about whoever I'm filming or whatever I'm filming. So I just want to be the vessel that gets that out for them.
All right. I respect that for sure. So when you are compiling a story together, do you take all the footage and realize, I see there's a narrative forming here where I didn't expect? Do you take that and try to thread the needle, as it were, to develop a more cohesive linear story? Or, once again, getting more into objectivity, do you prefer to let the most compelling footage speak for itself? It may be a little more all over the place, but it's more of a bigger picture as opposed to a focused based on what you've seen.
It really depends on the story. I think I usually prefer having some prep. I don't do a lot of prep for documentary because I want it to flow. But I prep it enough that you've got the structure that you can flow within. So something like Lanterns Flickered, for example, like I knew that I only had like 5 days to film there. And Dennis gave me the whole 5 days, did whatever we wanted. And like some of those moments that were in the film that were the most powerful were not planned at all. There's a part where he's just walking up to the cabin where his friend committed suicide. And because we were going to film there. And as we were walking, I noticed him playing guitar behind us, just gently and like very deep in his feelings. And I was like, all right, let's do that. So we got up and we filmed him playing guitar and walking up to it and singing the song that he wrote about him. And It's raw. Like you can't see it. Like it's, I didn't have proper camera movement. Like you see, it's very shaky and I just didn't care because that was like one of those raw moments that kind of hit from not planning it. I think in terms of the work that I've been doing for the last year, documenting the October 7th massacre and the war in Israel, that has been a lot more of, I didn't come do that to make a documentary about it. I came just to document it and to help the families who were affected. But there are documentaries that I'm working off that based on some footage that I thought, you know what, this actually works as a documentary. So, or someone whose story worked as a documentary and wanted that. So I'm working on two out of that now because of that situation. But that was one situation where just because of the chaos of the war and I was documenting everything, I was just within the 500 hours of footage or whatever I had, I was like, oh yeah, this person works as a story. So I'm going to build something from that. And then I see what I have and I see what I can then go film specifically for that story.
It's a pretty fascinating idea of what you're doing right now. You are in Israel right now and you're documenting a tragic event that happened a year ago in the middle of an ongoing war. So you're documenting the past while the present is still so chaotic at the same time. It's just, that's a lot. And I'm sure it'll be a fascinating final product. Because I feel like usually documentaries are more about things that happen after the fact, but you're living through a moment and keeping track of it as it's going.
100%. I don't even consider myself necessarily making a documentary about the past. I think most of us who were affected still feel like it hasn't been a year. It still feels very, very present. And I think because there's still hostages from October 7th, it still feels like the same event, just ongoing. So it feels like documenting it.
That's true.
Past and present is kind of combined in that. So that's where we're at. But yeah, it's very intense. I have a lot of friends whose families were killed or taken hostage, and I'm more doing it just to document for them and help them heal. For the families who were taken hostage, I don't think they'll start healing at all until their families are back. But yeah, that's basically what it's been for. I just did it just to document it for history, and within that found a few narratives.
So in that regard then, are you planning on releasing these documentaries further into the future once hopefully there's peace again and things start going back to normal? Or would you release these at the height of emotion while all this is happening right now?
Kind of both. There's two short documentaries I'm working on now that's, I think we'll be finished probably early next year. And those ones, their stories are kind of more complete. Like one of them is about five of my friends that survived the music festival, and it's about their escape, and it was about them going back for the first time, most of them. The five of them went back and we recreated their escape route. And that was like, I think the biggest thing for their healing was coming that full circle. So that story is just one that's more complete because it's about their healing. I'm working on another one about my friend who was one of the volunteers that was collecting bodies, and she basically did a special underwater diving project for her own healing because she's a scuba diver. So she basically went diving amongst a memorial, an underwater memorial that she made, and that was for her healing. So that one's specifically about the diving and her work. So I think those two I'm going to release probably nearer. And then I'm definitely going to do something much bigger after everything, because I'm still documenting no matter how long this war goes on, hopefully not too much longer. Hopefully the hostages come home ASAP and I can wrap that up. Yes. But yeah, I did show like a feature length documentary in April that I'd edited, just a very, very raw thing. I didn't even consider it a documentary at the time. It was just a 50 minute basically supercut of testimonies and footage that I'd been filming until some other people called it documentary. And I was like, all right, I'll call it one. That one's called Lenses of Lions. So I showed that in April when it was still, it's still very raw. You were only 6 months in at the time. And like, I went to film all of these places within 2 months of the massacre. So I've seen everything raw, everything before it was cleaned up and taped up by the police. And there's a lot in it, but I think in retrospect at the end of the war, it's going to be an interesting just piece of documentation, regardless if it's a feature-length documentary or not. It's just hundreds of hours that will document a point in history. And that I think is like the most raw form of documentary filmmaking I've ever done.
What you're saying all here is giving me a completely different perspective on what I imagine a documentary to be. I tend to think of documentary more as you have an idea and you set out to make a documentary. But the way you're describing things, I think, is infinitely more interesting. You just see things in the world and you got a camera and you want to film these things. You weren't even necessarily going out to make a documentary, like you said. That came after. And that's just very intriguing to me that a documentary can stem from, I'm just interested to see what's around. I'm just documenting. And then if a story presents itself, I can compile this into a more cohesive film for release. So,
yeah, 100%. I've done both ways. With Lanterns Flicker, I did it the way that I had an idea and then I prepped it. And we shot most of it. Most of it was set and prepped. There were moments that were not scripted, obviously, and we just flowed with it. I did a doc for A New Generation, which is going to be finished very soon, which was also, we did a lot of prep. We knew exactly what we were going in to do. It did flow. We ended up getting more filming days than we thought because we were able to shoot in other locations that we didn't expect. But that one was prepped. This one, I was just like, this is such a colossal event and it's going to be ongoing and there's no way to know what's going to happen with it. So it's just, you follow the event and like, it's just a documentation of history. So watching history unfold is how I'm going with it.
That one you were just talking about for A New Generation, that's the one about the audio visual display in the cattle car. Yeah, tell me
about that one. Yeah, so that one, that was 2021 we shot that. I was in Sheridan College during COVID. For postgrad, I did the advanced television and film production course there. And we had a very small group because of COVID. I think it was like maybe 24 or 25 of us. And most of the class ended up working on that afterwards. But that was a friend of mine from middle school made this cattle car exhibit. The cattle car was the vehicle the Nazis used to transport Jews and other undesirables to concentration camps or to labor camps or just all over Europe. So she had gone to Poland as a teenager and wanted to get into Holocaust education because she had family who survived. And she basically wanted to create this exhibit that you could bring around to schools and give you kind of the same feeling that you get from going to Poland. So the best way to do that was with a cattle car because it's transportable. And then one of her friends from high school is also a film director, Sagi Khan, I report, and he's great, great guy, great filmmaker, and he came from the tech side of filmmaking. So he wanted to create, like, the two of them kind of created this 360-degree audiovisual film within the cattle car. That's wow. Very, very immersive. It's very powerful. And it's a very good way to spread a message of anti-hate for everyone. And I very much connected to it because aside from the fact that I'm Jewish, I'm just against hate in general. And I think that was what really got to me. And then I experienced it and it was a really powerful exhibit. So I wanted to document the creation of it. And we made a short documentary about that that's being finished now. And yeah, it's been transported all over the US for the last few years since. And we filmed it in Florida. We had the DOP was in Florida with it. We did most of the filming in Ontario at some of the universities. And then I filmed at the Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem and at Auschwitz-Birkenau, actually in Poland. They let us film there. So I was there May 2022. I was there again this year filming, but the first time I went, which was for this project, it was May 2022.
Yeah, see, that's another sort of aspect that tries to break through more of my preconceived notions about documentaries, which I don't really watch a lot, to be honest, which I can get into in a little bit why I have these notions. But I tend to think of documentary more as localized, I'll say, more in a specific place with specific people. And situations like this prove that documentaries can be as exciting as other kinds of more traditional filmmaking. Oh, well, you know, these different set pieces around the world and getting to travel. You're doing the same thing as a documentarian, except you're just following real people instead of going to the Holocaust Museum, because that's where the script says this is where you go. You're following the story in a different kind of way.
Yeah, I really like doing that. I think it's a lot more powerful. I just kind of like, I have a starting point, and then it's kind of like writing a screenplay a little bit, because you just kind of have a starting point and then you have your idea of what the character should be doing, and then it just kind of flows from there. And like in screenwriting, I remember in York, they said like the characters kind of write the screenplay for you sometimes when it's just,
yes,
you understand them well enough, it just kind of flows out of that. And that just happens to me with the people I work with and the people I film.
I think that's why you've got a natural inclination to this, because as long as I've known you, you've also been very into screenwriting as a craft. You know how to present a story in fiction, and I believe you transferred those skills into real life, which is more unpredictable, but you still somehow find a way to make it work into a cohesive storytelling package.
Yeah, I think so. I remember they were telling us in screenwriting, which I did for all 4 years when I was in York. Really loved it. I still really love it. I don't do it as much, but
those are the best ones.
Yeah, I really loved it.
From what I remember.
Yeah, 100%. And I remember they were saying, because it was all about rewriting and everything, and they said the final rewrite is the edit. So I was like, all right, so I'll go into editing and write it like that. So that ended up being what I did with even Lanterns Flicker. Like, I wrote a brief script for it beforehand, and then it's interesting. Usually the way I structure documentaries when I'm editing them comes from the way I did screenplays. Because I would take the transcripts of every single interview and I would just do it based on that. So I would always do paper edits of interviews before I would actually edit, which I think not everyone does. I think it's very effective and it helps a lot. But I would actually read the scripts on paper before even looking at the interview footage. Like, that's just the way that I did it. And now that I'm thinking about it, it's probably from the screenwriting background. And then I would just figure out which visuals I wanted over that. But I very much structured it like a screenplay when I go into the edit.
For sure. So when you say putting visuals over the talking heads, that that's... Well, what am I trying to get out here? That is, I guess, the way the storytelling is done. It's the visual medium of it. Because it's one thing to just have a story told at you, but you have the power to hear someone tell the story in their own voice and also show it at the same time, in real time, which just... It's using a visual medium to its fullest extent. And I feel like that's where a lot of documentary filmmakers probably fall short, is they just have the stories being told, and that's more lecturing. It's informative, but not necessarily, I hesitate to say, entertaining. But also when people are watching a film, they have they want to be mentally stimulated. And I think that's a good technique to utilize from the sounds of things. Just layering the visuals over top of the storytelling. It's, once again, going back to your background
in
film.
I just want the emotion in it. Like, that's that's the key thing. If it makes, while I'm editing it and while I'm filming it, if I feel the same emotion while I'm cutting it that I did while I was filming it, then that's when I know the edit is right.
Yes.
So I'm like, if I feel the same way, because that's how I want the audience to feel as well, I don't want the audience to feel what I tell them to feel. I want them to feel what I felt while I was filming this person, while whoever it was telling me their story. I want their story to be like the driving force of all of it, and the driving force for the emotion. And I think that's really where I come from. It's just whatever visuals can support getting their emotion through, that's what I do.
That's a great way to think about things. So have you ever started on a documentary subject, but later found it was so boring you abandoned it altogether? Like, you're looking at these subjects, like you're saying, and you want to replicate the emotions they're giving you, but what if you just feel nothing?
Yeah, I did have that in Tel Aviv once, actually. I'm not going to say who it was, because they will be mad, but it was a music documentary in Tel Aviv that I... filmed like a few days for, and I was just like, there was nothing there. This was before the war. This was like 2 years ago. And it was like a couple musicians I really liked, and I really liked working with them, because they'd asked me to film a music video for them, and I was like, okay, they come from an interesting background. Like, I thought there could maybe be something to explore in their background and their music, but A, they just didn't have enough music at the time, and they didn't have enough narrative to fill what I needed to fill. Mm-hmm. And I told you, when it's like, I need to feel some sort of personal connection to whatever I'm directing. And yes. I felt it through music, but music is very surface level. There needs to be something deeper than that for me. So that one I filmed a few days, and I was like, that's it. I don't think I can bring anything out of this. And I probably could have. I could have created something, but it wouldn't have been anything meaningful for me. So I just scrapped it and went on to the next thing.
I guess that's going back to what I was saying before. That would have been you trying to make a more objectivist documentary. But without that passion behind it, it would probably come across as little emotional as you felt filming it.
Exactly. I think it just would have been bland if I'd gone with it without like having my heart in it. Like, and I can definitely make something like that. When someone hires me to edit something, I'm like, I can make it work. But I just, when I direct a project, I can't make it work like that.
Yeah, I suppose that's one question a lot of documentarians ought to ask themselves is, well, I could, but why bother?
Yep, 100%. It's like, I've got more important things for me that I wanted to be doing and wanted to be filming. So it was just a matter of that.
So how do you go about finding and contacting subjects for documentary interviews? Do you have people you know you want to contact, or do they just sort of fall into your lap? Or do you know people of people you know?
Yeah, it's usually a bit of both of that. It's for a new generation, I knew the people I wanted to interview for that because it was my friend first. I started with her and then Sigi, the filmmaker. And then the two Holocaust survivors that were in the film were the ones that they told the story of in the cattle car. So they connected me to them. And for Dennis, I literally emailed him for Lantern's Flicker after I listened to his album. I emailed him out of the blue and I was like, listen, you don't know me. I'm a veteran, I'm a musician, I'm a filmmaker, and I want to tell your story because it moved me. And he was like, all right, we had a Zoom call and we chatted and really worked out. I also need to connect with the people that I'm filming with. It can't just be an emotional connection to the story. I have to vibe with whoever I'm filming. Like, it has to be something like that. Because if I don't, then you're editing and filming with them forever. And it's just, you need to really have that personal connection to them too. Like, I have to get along with them. So I had that with Dennis 100%. Like, he's still such a good friend of mine. Like, I stay in touch with everyone I film almost. That's very different than, I think that's a huge difference between journalism and news and documentarians, for me at least, is when I come in to film someone, for example, since the October 7th massacre, I've done ridiculous amount of interviews. I come in not as a journalist, not as the news, and they're used to that. I'm like, I'm a friend with a camera. That's all I am. Like, it's just you and me, and that's it. And I really stay in touch with them. Like, I'm friends with a lot of people that I've filmed, and like, we have very meaningful friendships. And I think that's really what makes it work. But when it came to the war, I got to Israel end of November. I flew. So it was, it was like literally just less than 2 months into the war. And I started with people that I knew were affected. And then they obviously have friends that were affected. It's a very small country, so everyone kind of knows each other or has some kind of connection to each other. And it just spiraled from there. Everyone that was affected knew 15 at least other people who were affected. So it was just going from friend to friend to friend, and that was how it worked with this one. Sometimes there's a few that I know I want to interview, and then I kind of figure out how to contact them, and most of the time it's like through a mutual connection, because I have that with a lot of people.
Yeah. I like the idea you're saying that I'm not the news, I'm a friend with a camera. I feel like people on the news, they're either, some of them maybe are a little performative, like, oh, look at me, I'm on camera, I'm on broadcast, or maybe they're a little more the opposite way. I'm tense, I'm around an authority, I don't, you know, why am I spilling my secrets to you? You're going to broadcast this, you're going to twist this, you're going to make me look bad or misrepresent me. But the friend with the camera, it's like we were saying right at the very beginning, the small crew keeps people at ease. It's just a conversation, however that may go. And I think keeping people at ease like that, being that friendly face who just happens to have a camera in the room, and you just tell me what you want to tell me, I think that leads to more naturalistic presentation styles from your subjects, for sure. Has anyone ever said something on camera that they later regretted? And if so, what's your stance on removing said moment from a final film, especially if that moment was really compelling stuff?
I have had that. It depends on the subject matter. I will usually, I'll have a conversation with them about it, but, at the end of the day, if it's something very sensitive, then I will take it out. It's up to them. Like, it's, Usually it's like they won't be a part of the editing, but if they specifically text me and say, this thing really impacted me, or this thing I don't want my family to know sometimes, or friends to know, or like it's something like that, then I will 100% do it. Because whatever I'm doing, like, I know other filmmakers that won't do that, and I'm not a fan. I 100% do it for them. Like, even what you said before, like, the news wants to use them for an angle and do that. I come in and I tell them, like, I will film this, but if you don't want any of this public, like, if you just want this interview to be for your family to have, then that's fine with me, and I'll still do it. Because at the end of the day, like, I'm dealing with very serious subject matter. And it's just to heal them. That's, like, my only goal on this earth is to help heal people through film, and or through filming them and helping them with their testimonies. And because I've been through trauma myself, obviously different kinds, I'm able to speak to them on that level. But if it's something very, very sensitive, then I'm like, 100%, I will definitely not put that in for you. Like, it's a trust level. It's a trust that builds up between filmmaker and person. Again, it's like just a trust between friends.
So that effectively, I'm assuming, will answer my next question, which was, how would you handle a serious question of ethics in a documentary, like uncovering a truth which may cause more harm than good if broadcast? Is your chief duty as a documentarian to an objective truth despite the fallout, or to the emotional stability of your subjects or society?
It honestly depends on the kind of truth. Like, if it's something that's dangerous to someone else, like, if it's, I can't remember what documentary it was, but there was the story of someone who, like, accidentally confessed to a crime because they left their lav mic on in the bathroom. And then they used that. And I was like, if it's something like that, then that's a danger to other people. So yes, I would definitely report it and tell them about that. But most of the time with the subject matter I'm working on, it's just like, it's small personal details that they don't want public. And I'm like, it's nothing major. It's usually nothing like that. Ethically, like, I'm there for the subjects. If the person says something that is very, very harmful, that's something explosive like that, then I would definitely report it to someone.
Yeah.
I would even figure out reporting it before I put it in the final film.
Yes. I suppose the exploitation game only gives you a couple of cards to play. You do that too many times and you get a reputation. Oh, this guy is gonna, this guy's gonna try to get the gotcha moment.
100%. I'm not about that. I'm definitely not about the gotcha moment. I'm just about the, how can I help you? And how can you help me? It's like, editing this is also very healing for me because of the subject matter. I've been through most of it. So it's just a two-way friendship that we're developing through filming. That's like the way I see it for documentary, or the, at least the documentary is how I make them.
Love that sentiment. Definitely. So a more light question. Have you ever had to deal with a situation where your equipment just fails you? Like, your audio glitched and you didn't realize till after the fact, and the great footage is just unusable now?
Oh yeah, it sucks. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen sometimes. There was a time that I thought I lost two or three, I think. Yeah, I think it was three lavs because the card was corrupted or something. And it was like a very, very important interview. I don't freak out. I just calmly, like, go to whichever store and see if they can save it. Usually, like, I've lucked out and they have been able to. I'm also very, very good at backing things up. So I don't have that issue with hard drives because I always make 2 to 3 backups of everything and keep one in a bomb shelter. And in terms of cameras glitching, I think maybe once I've had that, but it didn't really affect much. I think it was, there was one day I remember filming that a drive crashed and they couldn't get it back, like an SD card crashed and they couldn't get it back, and I was upset by it, but like it is what it is. It happens in life, and you just move on and keep filming.
That's, yep.
No need to dwell on it if it's over.
Yeah, I mean, you got to keep moving on into the day, I guess. Would you ever recontact somebody for an interview like that if something drastic happened? Or, oh, no, moment's gone. I got the emotion out of them. I can't replicate that again.
Maybe sometimes. If it was very, very necessary to the final product, then yes. But if it's just something that I'm not sure if I'm even going to use it in the final, then I would probably do it much later, closer to when I'm finished.
Makes sense. So you did say earlier that you don't really get on camera very much or insert yourself, but do you document your documentary process at all? The making of, effectively? If anything, just for yourself.
I always take photos. Definitely take a lot of photos doing it, but
that's a document.
Filming wise, not so much. I think it's, people have told me to a lot more because I've got a presence on social media now, which I never expected to have, because I'm very much not that kind of person, but they were saying you should film yourself speaking about it, film this. And I'm like, I just don't like being on camera, but I'm starting to get used to it more. So I will probably do that more in the future, but so far, I haven't done much. It's mostly been just kind of behind-the-scenes photos and that kind of thing. But in terms of actually filming it, usually it's just such a small crew that, or it's just me, so there's like no one to even do it. So it's just a matter of that. Like, I couldn't even do it if I wanted to. I'm like, I've got to hold one camera. I can't hold both. So sometimes if I have an extra hand on set with me, then I do it, but very, very rarely.
All right. Well, that's all I've got for you today. Do you have anything else you want to mention or discuss about this?
About documentaries?
Yeah.
I think the documentary industry is exploding, which is a good thing. I think the streaming services made that happen, specifically doc series. But I'm just happy that, like, more people than ever, I think, are actually watching documentaries, because I think it's a very underrated medium. And yeah, I just love being a part of that world.
Yeah, I've never really been much into documentaries myself, as I said earlier. And I feel like part of that for me is because, well, I'll just say I'm a bit of a coward, I guess. Sometimes reality is a little too unnerving, so I tend to be more comfortable with fictionalizations of true events than seeing people tell their own story. Like, it's for people who really appreciate raw emotion and a direct reflection of reality, it's perfect, and I want to be more that person, because it is, you know, reality is reality, and shouldn't want to shy away from it. But I feel like, if anything, that's my excuse for not getting more into documentaries, or at least the more hard-hitting stuff. Like, I'll watch, you know, documentaries on
the
behind the scenes of films or whatever, but yeah,
it's funny, I watch less documentaries now that I make them. I used to watch way more. Now I just kind of watch them at festivals, just because if I come home from filming in a combat zone or anywhere with very heavy, intense subject matter, like the kibbutzim in southern Israel I've been at nonstop, and those are like, I was there when the houses weren't clean and there's still blood everywhere and nothing was cleaned up yet. And like, I come back from that or interviewing someone whose family member was killed or family member was hostage or an actual released hostage, and I come home and I'm like, I'm not going to watch a documentary now. That's what I do for a living. So I need to watch something else. So I usually watch comedy to unwind I'm mostly into comedy TV shows. And that's,
I guess you got it. Like, you see,
it's funny, when I'm not working, I watch them more.
Yeah, you see a lot of heavy stuff, so I don't imagine you'd want to see more of that on your downtime.
Exactly. I watch docs a lot at film festivals. I really love doing that. But most of my downtime now, I barely watch them anymore, just because of everything that's like filming, everything is nuts. And I'm just like, reality is intense, so I don't want to come home and watch something intense. But I do watch music docs a lot still. Like those ones, whenever a doc comes out about an artist that I love, I'll always watch that.
Yeah. All right, so where can we find you on social media, or your next, your upcoming documentaries, or the ones currently playing? So where can we find your stuff right now?
Yeah, so my website is yonicollins.com, and my Instagram handle is yonicollinsfilms. That's where I post most of what I do. A lot of the behind-the-scenes photos and behind-the-scenes stuff and everything I'm working on is there. Yeah, that's basically where to find me.
All right, and you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook at Thought Play Media. Also, check out the Close Up with Ryan and Joe Facebook page for latest updates on the show. If you listen to us in audio, check out our YouTube channel. And if you're on YouTube, find us anywhere you get your favorite podcasts. Thank you very much for coming out and sharing your stories with us, Yoni. That's a lot of powerful stuff in there, and you've been a great guest. Hope to have you on in the future sometime again. So we hope to see you on the next Close Up with Ryan and Joe. Till next time.